Hey, welcome to Hindsight, the podcast. I'm your host, Lee Jones, and I'm thrilled to embark on this journey of exploration with you. We often find ourselves reflecting on the choices we've made and wondering how our lives might have unfolded differently if we had taken a different path. Here's the beauty of hindsight. It gives us a chance to gain wisdom and learn from our past decisions. Look, this podcast is a platform to dig deep into those pivotal moments and uncover the invaluable lessons hidden within. Look, I'm Lee Jones, your host, and I couldn't be more excited to have you on board. So let's dive right in and explore the fascinating realm of decisions on Hindsight the Podcast.
When you look back in hindsight, everything is 2020. In hindsight, we make mistakes, we're learning from it. In hindsight, it should be your today and your tomorrow. In hindsight, it's so much clearer now.
This is Hindsight the Podcast, and introducing your host, Lee Jones.
Hey, welcome to Hindsight the Podcast. I'm your host, Lee Jones, and today my guest is Kevin Dunlap, a true powerhouse in the world of entrepreneurship and education. As the founder of Optimal Performance Academy, he's a go-to expert for entrepreneurs and small business owners. From his U.S. Navy days stationed in Japan to his journey as a math teacher and beyond, Kevin's story is a tale of dedication. He made his mark in real estate, authored 3 books, and recently penned a guide on business launch strategies. Kevin's Academy helps entrepreneurs navigate the business landscape without being overwhelmed. His aim? To guide 1,000 businesses to the six-figure mark and beyond. Let's get to it. On your feet? That's a military joke. Welcome. How you doing, Kevin Dunlap?
I'm doing well, Lee. How about yourself?
I'm doing good. I'm doing pretty good. Thank you so much. We had a little technical details at the beginning of this before this episode got started, and Kevin put his skills right to the test and gave me some strategies on how I can better the communication with my guests going forward. So, Kevin, I just want to say thank you first and foremost for those tips, those free tips, by the way, that you helped me out along the way.
It's my pleasure. And I always like to check links before I, you know, I get on a show or be a guest. And usually an hour before, so that gives me time to correct them if something was wrong. And I'm glad I did this time.
Hey, so Kevin, tell us a little bit about yourself. I went very vaguely. I did touch on the Navy thing. I'm an Army guy. I retired from the Army a few years back. So go Army, right? But tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, yes, I grew up in a small town just outside of Pensacola, Florida. So I fully understand what it was like to come from a small town. We had one red light and 2 grocery stores. And the Piggly Wiggly is still there, by the way.
Piggly Wiggly. What a name for a grocery store, but I love it.
I love it. And actually, got a good off topic here, but I saw this a day in the museum or something, you know, that TV show that goes into the history of something. Piggly Wiggly is actually known to make – they changed the world.
How's that?
Before Piggly Wiggly, when you walk into a store, you go up to the clerk behind the register and tell them what you want, and that clerk would go and get things off the shelf. Piggly Wiggly actually said, you know what, let's give people baskets and have them get their own stuff off the shelves. So they were the first store to do that, by the way.
The pioneers of the modern day supermarket experience. That's awesome. I didn't know that.
I did not know that either until I saw that episode. But anyway, going back to your original question. I grew up in a small town, and then I was very anxious to get out of town. So, you know, like a lot of young men and women, for that matter, I joined the U.S. Navy on the same year that I got out of high school. I actually was going in the Navy within like a month of getting out of high school. But my recruiter asked me if I would wait until November so they can get somebody else to take my spot, because that person was about to reach their 1 year maximum. So I ended up going in November of the same year I graduated high school. And that actually, one of the things that changed my life, I traveled the world, saw 14 countries. I was able to, you know, see them. I was able to see other countries, not only for free, but to get paid to go see those countries, because, you know, being in the military.
Yeah. And Let me chime in real quick. I used to love those trips as well. So go ahead.
Well, yeah. Because the thing is, when a young impressionable man, you know, from a small town, is now, I'm in Korea, I'm in Japan, I'm in China, I'm in all these other countries, you start to get the experience how other people live, and it helps you to appreciate other people's cultures and things along those lines. And I think that was one of the first parts of my journey. After getting out, of course, I went to college, went to grad school, got a degree in mathematics, went to study meteorology as a subject, then was a computer programmer. And then in 1999, I was working on the Y2K project, and then I was finishing up one subcontracting gig, and I took my 2-week vacation in June. Came back, and a few weeks after I got back, my boss said, "We cannot find you in any other gigs. And by the way, we're going to let you go. Oh, in that second week of vacation, since you took in the middle of the year, we're taking that out of your final paycheck."
Oh my goodness.
And therefore, I got kind of turned off to corporate America. I swore I would never work full time for corporate America again. I did work a little bit part time jobs as a college math teacher. I was also doing, and this is so, my life is so varied, and I was also doing part-time stunt work for film, and then a fight choreographer for stage. So I have that experience as well. That led me to starting to start investing in real estate. I moved to Las Vegas, ended up in 2004, ended up starting a real estate consultation business where I was helping other owners to find higher quality tenant buyers for their homes through a lease option program that I created. And that led me to becoming a realtor. That was 18 years of my life right there, just doing that. And now after writing my fourth book, which came out last year, which was basically on how to start a business, I decided when I moved from Las Vegas to Raleigh in March of 22 that I would actually start a business where I would teach other entrepreneurs. So that's when I formed Optimal Performance Academy. And Academy is basically a school that I'm building. We have a number of online courses. We're constantly adding more courses every single couple of weeks. I have group and private consultation services. We have workshops that we're doing. We have live trainings, live free trainings that we're doing. I have a classroom that is the recording of all those live trainings that I've done. So if you ever want to go back and re-listen to it again, you can, or listen to ones that you may have missed because you're out of town or you didn't know about us yet. And that's exactly what we're doing right now.
Man, I tell you what, I'm listening to all the different things you've done, especially the stunt, you know,
yes.
the stunt crew stuff. I don't know what you call it, but you was a stunt man, right?
Stunt man, stunt coordinator, mainly for independent films, low budget independent films. And then my original training in stunts was when I lived in Raleigh in 98, 99.
Yeah.
And I learned stage combat. And that was mainly it was with weapons like a rapier and a dagger or a quarterstaff. And then hand-to-hand combat. You know, how do you throw a punch on stage to sell that it was a punch, where the audience would like, did he really just hit that guy? And of course, we're doing it safely because we're missing each other by several inches because of the way that we throw the punch. And
right.
There's a lot of plays that have fights in them. I mean, my two biggest plays was Hamlet and Macbeth.
I always wanted to get involved in some sort of film creation or just be a part of it, right? It just looks kind of cool, right? And then to be able to see yourself on screen, I think would probably be an amazing thing.
Or if you're a stuntman, you see that you see Tom Cruise fall down those stairs. That's not Tom Cruise. That's a stuntman. That's not making.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's not Tom. I did that scene.
That's pretty cool. This is Hindsight, the podcast, and thank you for going back a little bit. But looking back, what's a specific failure that surprisingly became a turning point for your career and life's trajectory? And how did it set you on a new path? Now, you gave one example about how they just did you wrong at that company, just let you go, right?
Yep.
And that kind of put some things in motion, right? You had some time in the Navy, which gave you different perspectives. And I wholeheartedly agree with you. When you go to these different locations, it can be different states in this country, right? But when you also add in other countries in your travels and you get to understand the different cultures and how people are, right? You have a better appreciation of reality, or you start to reform your idea of what reality is, right? Just because you've been a part of those experiences. So that is one thing that I definitely credit, you know, the good and the bad with the military, being deployed in a combat zone, or just training exercise, or just going to a country and supporting some sort of mission. All of those experiences for me culminated into a sort of socialization that helped me to better sharpen my idea of what reality is. Does that make any sense?
Absolutely. I mean, if you want, I'll just share one of my early big mistakes that actually became one of the best things that ever happened to me.
There you go.
It was when I joined the Navy in 85 when I joined. I joined under the nuclear power program. And at that time, that was the most prestigious program outside of SEALs, you know, outside of the special forces stuff. But that was one of the most prestigious programs that the whole military had at that time. And after I got a basic training, some people call it boot camp. After I got a basic training, I was going to my schooling to get my education on the subject that I was going to be doing. In that case, it didn't really matter what it was. And then after I finished that schooling, I would go to nuke power school. Well, an incident happened. This was in Waukegan, Illinois, which is right next to the Great Lakes Navy base there. An incident happened that actually put me, this was an Easter weekend of 1986. Something happened that actually put me, I was detained by the police until Monday morning when I had a hearing. I was let go of one of the charges, and the other charge they convicted me of, $150 fine. And I went back to base. Well, base said, well, being in jail is no reason that you're not at your duty station. So I had to go to captain's mess because of that. And out of the seven people that were at captain's mess at the time that I went, I was number six in line. The five in front of me were a restriction to the ship, as well as a reduction in rate and a fine. This judge or this captain basically said, we'll let you go. Don't let it happen again. And then the last guy got reduction in rate and a fine. And so I had to file what they call a CHIT, CHIT, to stay in the nuclear power program. Well, I will go ahead and finish my A school, and I graduated with an 89.6 GPA. I have to have a 90 GPA. I go, well, I only missed like one or two questions on the final exam. I'm just putting another CHIT to stay in nuclear power school. And they say, we have a hard rule. You cannot have two CHITs. You're now out of nuclear power school. The whole reason I joined the Navy. And now it's like, what am I going to do for the next 4 years of my life when the whole reason I joined the Navy was for this? So I was put into what they call TPU, or temporary processing unit, because they had no idea where to send me. Because at that time, they're like, you're supposed to be going to nuke power school, but now you're not going there. We don't know what to do with you. So about 3 months go by before I got my orders to go to my ship. And that ship happened to be in Yokosuka, Japan. So that started 2 years of my first ship in Japan, and then my second ship, because I still had time to serve, was I decided to stay in Yokosuka and ended up living in Japan on two different ships for 4 years. Mm. So that if I would have gone to nuclear power school at that time, nuclear ships were not ported in any foreign country; they could only be in the United States. So now I look at that. It's like that night, you know, that night that I got arrested, it was a bad night because of that. It kind of caused me to get out of the nuclear power program. But it was the catalyst that changed my life forever for, you know, being able to experience other cultures and living with other people from other countries. So I look at that as like that was a great turning point. Even though at the time, you're like, what am I going to do? What am I going to
exactly.
do? I mean, imagine being put in jail. I mean, I'm a young kid just outside of Chicago, being in jail in a dormitory jail. So I'm sharing a room with 35, 40 other people. that are in there for all kinds of different reasons.
Right.
And I'm there by myself.
I tell you what, and this is probably not a reflection of the Navy and the Army. I recall one time we had a formation in the morning and the commander got up and one of the guys had been arrested over the weekend, but four or five of them had went out and was at a bar party. And I think they went to Canada or something. And so the messaging from our commander was pretty funny. Not really funny, but his perspective was, why did I go and pick up one of you from jail for fighting and five of you all went out there? So it's either none or all of you, right? If one person gets into a fight, everybody gets into a fight and everybody should get arrested. And I was like, what kind of unit am I in? Right. But I was in a light infantry unit. I'm a supply person, right? And I was assigned to a light infantry unit out in upstate New York at Fort Drum. And it's just a funny mentality. So I just wanted to share that. You made me think about that when you talked about the arrest. So when you were in Japan, you explored on those two ships, you explored 14 countries in that time period.
Yes. And I'm and my Navy people may know this. The rest of you listeners may not, but I am what they call a shellback. And what that means is I've gone through, it's a Navy ritual that you go through, and it's kind of disgusting ritual, where it was that when you cross the equator, the people that have not crossed the equator are called WOGs. And I was fortunate to actually participate in that ritual. So I'm an honorable shellback. I've actually crossed the equator twice. And when I say twice, I mean the first time we crossed and then we came back, and the second time we crossed and we came back. So technically it's four times, but you're only talking about when you're going from north to south as crossing the equator.
All right, I'd be a terrible host if I didn't ask you to elaborate on this disgusting ritual that you just mentioned. So what happens once you cross the equator?
Okay, so number one, they strongly suggest that you get two sets of knee pads because you're going to be on your hands and knees the entire day or during the entire ritual, which is going to last about 4 or 5 hours. So if you've ever been on ship before, you got that non-skid paint, that's mm-hmm. going to tear your feet and hands up. That's why they suggest you get knee pads. Mm-hmm. Some people will get old fire hoses. They will go ahead and get like a 3 foot length. They will tape off one end for a handle, and then they soak it in salt water for weeks. So it becomes very, very hard. And you're going to get spanked with that thing. You're going to get spanked quite often with that thing. You are going to also have to do that. Each department has a WOG queen. So one guy in the department is going to have to dress up like a woman with makeup and everything and perform in front of all the other showbacks. And there's also going to be a WOG dog.
Oh my goodness.
And then, I mean, I've got pictures of when I was with Shellback when those walks were going through. You are also going to be jumping into a vat or a huge vat, like, you know, 10-foot vat mm-hmm. of disgusting water filled with all kinds of rotten food. You got to swim across it. So technically, at the end of the day, what all the WOGs do is once they're done, is that they will strip down to their underwear and they throw their clothes overboard because they can't be cleaned. It's just that far gone.
Oh my goodness!
That lasts for hours.
I tell you what, I was in the Army, and so we didn't go to ships to go to Japan. I did fly to Japan a couple times, and thankfully, we had to remain seated. With our, trays locked up in whatever the hell the message is that the stewardesses and them tell you, right? So we just flew in and then we flew back. We didn't have to, you know, go through this disgusting ceremony that you all had to go through.
But that's pretty cool. Say shellback ritual. Uh-huh. On Google and see if there's what kind of images that gets pulled up.
Shellback ritual.
I'm just guessing that's what it would be. Now, here's the funny thing. On my second ship when we crossed, the XO was a WOG. For those of you that don't know what that means the executive officer or the second in command.
The second in command, absolutely. And every I guess no one's exempt, huh?
Nobody's exempt. Now, they were more friendly with him. They were,
of course. Yeah, he still got to rate you. All right, so you've done a lot of things. And from a math teacher to a real estate entrepreneur to founding Optimal Performance Academy, I'm sorry, your journey spans on all the other things in between. So can you shed light on a misstep that led you to an innovative solution or an opportunity you wouldn't have otherwise discovered? One, you failed that test by a couple of points, right? So that definitely gave you an opportunity to get on those ships and get that beautiful experience over in Japan. But other than that, do you have any other missteps?
Well, I mean, there's always going to be missteps. I mean, I know in 2004, that's when I moved to Vegas in January 04. And it was about, I don't know, 6 months later that I started my real estate consulting business doing the lease options. Mm-hmm. Now, I was working with another group of people that were investors that were doing seller financing type properties. And they were part of a company called Nouveau Riche. They were the Las Vegas branch. And out of the seven people, none of them lived in Vegas. So I became their go-to local person. And but then they folded, and then I started. But I still had that network of investors. So that's when I started my lease option consultation business. Now, that lease option, because we were actually having people buy people that could not buy a house, we were having them. I would put them under contract, find an investor to buy the house, add 25% to that on a 1 year contract because housing markets were going up 30-40% at that time. And then, of course, there was that housing crunch that completely destroyed my business. Like, how do you have a business where somebody buys a house and then they're going to add a property to that so that the investor, makes money on it when everything's dropping 10, 15, 20, 30, even 50%. So that, I mean, for me, I had to completely change my business model. I had to completely change how I was doing things. It was a difficult transition, but, you know, I figured something out, and it took me, you know, almost being bankrupt when that happened. I mean, I still remember back in 07 when all that was going on, I lost my own personal house to foreclosure. Because I just couldn't make the payments anymore. But the thing is, I learned from that. And I can feel for somebody if they're losing their home to foreclosure. Because not only did I lose my house, but I lost like four other properties, either to short sales or to foreclosure. So that would affect my credit for several years, like nearly a decade.
Right. Wow.
Well, it's because I was keeping on one house, and then, so when my last house that finally went away, that was like 4 years later. So that 6 year, 7 year clock, that foreclosure being on your credit report, you know, when it finally left, I got down on my knees and thanked God. Thank you for taking this house, because instead of looking at it as a negative, I looked at it as now the clock starts, so I can actually buy something new in a few years. That's how I looked at it.
So did the market crash in the subsequent ending of your business there, did that prompt your move to Raleigh? What made you, why did you move to Raleigh?
Well, that's another interesting story. In September of 2021, my dad was in the hospital with a UTI. And my brothers and I were thinking about having him go into assisted living because we didn't feel like he could really fully take care of himself anymore. And he had just, you know, and my younger brother had convinced him to sell his tool business, which happened to be on the other side of the state line in Lower Alabama. And I think it was Summerdale or something like that. And he sold the business. So he sold the business and all the tools that he had in the store. And then he had a little shop or a little storage unit right next to this store that the buyer got that as well. But he still had five warehouses of tools back in Pensacola. So I went there to like, well, we got to find an assisted living facility. And then like, well, if he goes, then we've got to sell all of these tools as well. So, you know, I was going through the process of, you know, trying to organize things. And a week after I had arrived, my dad passed away. That prompted me to start to question about, you know, maybe I should move back to Raleigh, to the Raleigh area. And I just, and my, I've got a brother in DC, another brother in Birmingham. And I was like, well, I lived in Raleigh before, and maybe this will be a good time to maybe check it out. I didn't do anything about that. I ended up back in Vegas, and what happened between there, that's a completely another story that we might talk about. And then I flew back in January 22 to sell his house, his truck, and his and the contents of his house. And so I bought a one-way ticket because I don't know how long it's going to be. And I figured I had to be in Pensacola for, you know, to sign the closing docs. So I bought a one-way ticket and, you know, staying at my dad's house. And I got somebody to sell this stuff. And then I bought a one-way ticket a few weeks later to come check out Raleigh. This was mid-February. I drove around and just saw how green this city is, which is a lot different than Las Vegas. And I, you know, I was looking around. I said, "Well, maybe let me go try to find places to live." And they've got the yoga studios that I like. They've got co-working spaces. They've got all this other stuff. And it's a green city. And it's kind of halfway between my two brothers. And so I started looking at apartments because, you know, I didn't want to buy at that point because I didn't know Raleigh in order to just buy something, you know, willy-nilly. And then, you know, I ended up finding a place that I liked. I signed a lease and I had to, you know, my lease started March 1st. Or actually it started February 25th. And then, you know, I ended up 2 weeks later, I moved to Raleigh. And I mean, I like it here. It is a very green state. And I've seen my brothers more frequently now than I did when I was living in Vegas. Because, I mean, how often are you going to fly out to Vegas? But, you know, my younger brother's only a 4-hour drive away instead of, you know, three time zones.
I can appreciate your recognizing how green it is. Leaving Southern California, which is beautiful, right? But it's still dry. It's not as vibrant. I'm from Maryland. So I'm okay. Very familiar with the East Coast, but I've been here in California for about 11, 12 years now. And I tell you what, going back east, going south, you know, any of those places other than here, it's just, it has its own charm. And I'll just leave it at that.
Well, there are plus and minuses. One thing I do miss after living in Vegas for 18 years is I miss living in the Pacific time zone. Like, oh my God. Like, if you want to watch a football game and it starts at 7 o'clock here and it ends at 11 o'clock at night in Vegas, it's like it starts at 4 in the afternoon. We'll watch the game, then we'll grab dinner. Like, God, I miss that.
I'm still enjoying that, by the way. Hey, so you wrote some books, Designing Your Own Destiny.
Correct.
The Winner's Code, Secrets of the Winner's Mindset. And then you wrote Launch, right?
Correct.
The A to Z in creating a successful business.
Correct.
I'm still working on one. Was there any moments during the writing process when it didn't seem like you'd ever finish writing it? And if so, how did you like push through that writer's block?
Well, there was a fourth book that I wrote that came up before Designing Your Own Destiny. And it was called Lease Options Made Easy. And the subtitle was How to Buy a Home with Little, No, or Bad Credit, which is all about lease options. I don't put that in my signatures on my emails. I don't promote that one too much, even though it is my first book. However, that came out in 2015. And at that time, I wanted to become an author. And what I ended up doing with that book, and then I'll answer your question. What I wanted to do with that book, I just wanted it to come out. Now, on my website back then, I had an FAQ. I think 39 questions and answers for frequently asked questions. And that FAQ became the template of my book, of my first book. Now, I must admit, and I will admit this, when I wrote that first first draft of that book, it was garbage. Oh my God, it was so boring. So I decided I would actually make it a narrative. So I created two characters, a husband-wife character, which had bad credit, and they were about to go to a seminar on lease option real estate. So there was a third character, the speaker, as well. And what I wanted to do was talk about different things as far as the lease option is concerned, you know, financing, stuff like that, but having the husband and the wife have different perspectives on it. So therefore I was able to, instead of just giving a factual book that would just give you like one perspective, I was able to give two perspectives because I wrote a factual book as a narrative. Now, I still don't think it's the best work that I've done. So in my second book, Designing Your Own Destiny, I actually hired a book writing coach named Patrick, and he was in Hawaii. And I ended up hiring him, and he gave me some templates and principles on how to write a book. And I used that one to write that second book. And that book took me a year to write because, I mean, I was still new to the writing process. And some of the secrets that he talked about, if you're writing a factual book, is number one, because a lot of books, you're going to have stories in them. And even the, you know, the getting arrested story is in that book. And he said, basically just, you know, write down, you know, all the stories, write down 100 stories, 110 stories. And then that's either happened to you or happened to people that you know. And then he says, and then make sure that at least no more than 49% of the stories that you're going to be telling are about yourself. Because if you go over 49%, then it becomes an autobiography. So don't make it an autobiography. So you have to be learning lessons that you learn from other people.
Right.
And so I wrote those down. And then he says, okay, you know, what is the book about, the topic of the book? Then write down, he says, how many chapters are you going to be in the book? So you figure out how many chapters you want in your book. And then basically what he said was, my second book was 22 chapters. So I got out 23 pieces of paper, copy paper or printer paper. I wrote the title or the working title on the front of the first page, and then the name of the chapters on those other 22 pages. And then I got the stories that I had in there. This is like, this is chapter 15, this is chapter 12, this is chapter 9, this is chapter 22. And then, so now you've got your basic outline for your book. And then after that, and then he would say, then go ahead and write that book. You know, go ahead and write that first draft. Now, here's the kicker. And this is why a lot of people fail at writing a book. He says, and I fully believe him. He said, whenever you write your book, go ahead and write it, you know, write the, you know, based upon your outline, and just write and write and write, because don't correct any errors. Don't go back and look at chapter one. You write on all the way until the very end. And what he said was, this is going to be the biggest piece of crap anybody has seen. You're not going to show it to anybody. But the thing is, you've got your first draft done. Once you have the first draft done, print it. And I suggest you have page numbers turned on. Print it, because you don't want to have a 100-page book and all of a sudden your papers get out of order. So make sure you have your page numbers turned on. Subtle hit. Learn from experience. And then you start editing it. So my first book, it went through four drafts. I still have all four drafts.
Right.
Printed drafts, that is.
Right.
And then I hired a content editor. And it went through four more drafts with him. So, I mean, it went through, this is why it took so long to write the book. Because I was, you know, I was going through through that much detail. Now, my book was also a workbook. And when I write books, my second and fourth one is particularly, which are both workbooks, I always want to do something different that nobody has ever done before, or at least most likely has never done before. So it's a way to be unique. And, you know, like in most personal growth, most personal development books, people have quotes at the very beginning of the chapter. And sometimes they have other quotes throughout the chapter. But, you know, at the very, you have the title of the chapter, you have a quote, and then you have then you go into the material.
Yes.
Okay. So most quotes that people use are going to be quotes that are either by, you know, they were like, say, they're going to be a Gandhi quote, or they're going to be a Walt Disney quote, or they're going to be, you know, somebody like that. And usually when you read quotes, now we understand through our five senses, our three main senses that we learn from are our eyes, which is visual, our auditory or touching, which is kinesthetic. Well, most quotes are going to be feeling based. They're going to be kinesthetic based. And when I wrote Designing Your Own Destiny, I said, you know what? I want quotes to have a visual, an auditory, and a feeling based. So all the quotes in my book, with the exception of maybe one, and there's quite a few in there. Mm-hmm. All the quotes in the book were quoted by someone that did not exist.
What does that mean? Quoted by someone that did not exist. You just made them up?
No, they were all movie quotes. So the very first quote in the book is the red pill, blue pill quote from The Matrix. So when you read the quote, you not only do you get a good, the quote is good, but maybe you're listening and you're thinking, oh, this, I'm hearing Lawrence Fishburne in my head.
Yep.
And I've seen that scene in my head. The hardest part was there's two chapters that took me almost 2 months to come up with a quote for. It's like this chapter is on this topic. I've got to find a movie quote that people would know based upon that chapter. Like there is one quote, one of my other favorite ones in the movie was out of one of the Batman movies. And it's a quote by the Joker, and he says, "This is what happens when an unstoppable force meets an unmovable object."
Yeah, remember that too.
Yeah, that's when Batman was on the motorcycle, you know, racing towards the Joker.
Okay, that's a great strategy, and you got that strategy from your coach.
The strategy of writing the book came from the coach. Having the movie quotes was my own strategy.
My man, I got you.
As well as how I got my testimonials was my own strategy. Let me ask you this. How do you get a testimonial for a book before the book is ever printed? Have you ever thought about that? Like, oh, as I think, well, I'll even give your listeners and even yourself basically how I got most of my testimonials before my book was even published. It was, I would, instead of having somebody read a 22-chapter book, it's going to be like 250-some-odd pages long, I went and actually found 10 friends, and I would say, let's say you, Lee, I say, hey, Lee, you're my friend here. I want to get a testimonial from you, if you don't mind, and you as my friend. So, of course, I'll help you out. I go, okay, I'm going to send you to chapters 1, 11, and 13. Could you give me a testimonial on those three chapters? And then you say, yes, you will. And then I'll go to my friend Noah. I go, hey, Noah, I'd like to get a testimonial. Would you read chapters 1, 12, and 19 and give me a testimonial? So what I ended up doing, I contacted like 12 friends. I sent the same three chapters to two people, but I mixed it up as far as, you know, as far as the next set of two. So therefore, they're giving me testimonials on what they've read. That if I accept them all the same chapters, they're going to give me the same testimonial for the most part. So I said, let me mix it up a little bit. And that's how I got all my testimonials. That's how I do all my testimonials now.
I just need to write the book and get some chapters so I can get them out to my friends. And I'll give you a call when that time comes.
Well, I'm going to give you another little piece of advice now. I mean, there's this tool that you can use to help you at least get your outline of your book. It's called ChatGPT.
Yeah, I got the outline. I got everything down for the most part. And it's just about filling in the meat. You know mm-hmm. what I mean? So that's where I'm at right now.
Well, that's what I mean by just going and create that first draft. That's the main thing. And here's another thing. I came up with this myself, I think. I don't think I heard it. If you are the word author, do you know what word is derived from? Which English word is derived from?
No, which one?
Authority.
Mm-hmm. You're an authority on a certain.
You're an authority on a certain topic. So if you want to stand out in your business, having a book is one of the best ways to do that. Because let me ask you this. If I told you I did lease options and then my friend Bob, he says he does lease options as well, and you've heard that we both do a good job, and I tell you I have a book, and that's all that you know, and it's assumed the book has good content, who do you trust more?
Right, person with the book. Because they're an authority. So those are good tips, and let's focus right here. Let me stop real quick and reiterate. One strategy to help you out is to get you a coach. To help write with the outline and just get your thoughts together, right, is to maybe utilize the ChatGPT tool. And then also understand that as a business owner or as a brand ambassador or whatever it is that you're doing, writing a book, being an author of a book makes you an authority on a certain topic, right? Specifically the topic that you're focusing on in the book. So these are excellent points to consider. Kevin, when you're a small business owner or a big business owner, whatever it is you're trying to do, right?
And the thing is, you're not writing the book necessarily to make money off of the book itself. You want to make money from the book, not off the book. And there's a big difference. By having a book make money from the book, you can give your book away for free as a free lead magnet for somebody signing up for one of your courses.
All right, so now I'm gonna step out of the book writing thing, and I'm gonna actually talk about you helping. So as someone who helps entrepreneurs avoid pitfalls, what's one or two common or uncommon mistakes that you see us small business owners make repeatedly? And what advice do you offer based on your own experiences?
Well, I mean, some of the biggest things I see is not having the right attitude. Because being an entrepreneur is not meaning that you're a nine-to-fiver. It means you're not a nine-to-fiver anymore. This means that you don't have a boss anymore. And therefore, this means that you have to go and get your own leads. You're going to have to go and get your own generation. Even if you're a real estate agent and you have a broker, you're still your own business. So the thing is having that right mentality. It's a huge mindset thing. Because a lot of reasons I see people fail is because they're just not thinking like an entrepreneur. Now, when I was in Las Vegas as a realtor, as an example, Las Vegas is a very service-oriented town. Yeah, so I would say probably 20%, 25% of what it does, it offers services. And then everybody else has their regular day job. They work at the grocery store, they do whatever. But because it's so high service oriented, a real estate agent has to be available 7 days a week, because you've got to you show houses on the weekends for your regular day job people, and then you show houses during the week for all your people that work, the dancers, the bartenders, the valets, all of those people, because they're working the weekends. That's where all the tourists are in town. So you have to adopt a mindset that you are running a business, no matter what that business is. And the second thing is also more of a time management thing. It's being able to know how long things are going to take. And also, my biggest pet peeve, and I learned this as a child, is never be late for your appointments, ever. I mean, if you're going to be somewhere at 2 o'clock and it takes you 30 minutes to get there, well, you should be leaving by 1:15, no matter what it is. I mean, it's better that you're sitting in your car because you got early, than your client or potential client is sitting in their car and, let's say, in Las Vegas, 115 degree temperatures, waiting for you to show up because you always show up 10 minutes late.
Yeah, I know. One of the lessons we learned in the Army is if you're early, you're on time, and if you're on time, you're late.
I think, well, Vince Lombardi's quote, I think, was, if you're 15 minutes early, you're late.
Yeah. Hey, so let's have a little bit of fun. Sure. And it's fun for us at your expense. Okay. So if you could travel back in time to any failure that you encountered, not to change the outcome, but to have a good laugh and learn, which failure would it be? And why would you choose that one?
I mean, I don't know why this is coming to mind. I remember I was learning how to rollerblade, and the thing was, I was learning how to do it, and I was wanting to try to impress somebody that I was, like you were saying, I was showing off, and then all of a sudden I realized there was a person that was suddenly in front of me that was walking their dog, and the dog was on the other side of the sidewalk than they were. Oh, by the way, there was a leash in between those two.
Oh, shoot.
So yeah, I bit the dust.
how did you feel? Do you remember? How did you feel at that moment?
Oh, I was like, just humiliated.
yeah. End of the world. This is the end of the world. I can't believe this is happening.
This reminds me even of another time when I was a kid. I think my brother was with me, and I was riding my bicycle really, really, really fast. And then I said, well, I've got to stop. And I forgot which one is the front brake, which was the back brake.
Oh, Lord.
So I squeezed the right-hand one. And I always squeeze the right-hand one. And so that we were locked, but I still had my momentum going. So that I ended up flipping over the handlebars, landed on the ground face down, and the bicycle landed on top of me with the wheels still up in the air.
Oh. So you know, the key to this whole thing is, you know, we all go through life and we all have these embarrassing moments or some things that just didn't go out the way we planned them to go out, right, in our heads. But that's not the end of the story, right? So as long as you're still going, as long as you're still kicking, right, just keep trying those things and you're going to figure it out. You're going to figure out what it is that you need to be doing or should be doing, right? And don't beat yourself up too much. So I got another question for you because I read this and I want to understand your, you know, how do you gauge this? You're striving to guide 1,000 entrepreneurs. Is it 1,000 to six-figure success and beyond? Why 1,000? Where are you at in that number? And what do you do once you do all 1,000? Do you make another goal?
Of course. The thing is with goal setting, once you achieve, one of the happiest days of your life should be when you achieve a goal, and the saddest day should also be that same day, because now you're there. And then what's next? Why 1,000? Because I'm building this business, I wanted to give myself something tangible, because I'm not the person that's going to say, I want to make $250,000 in this endeavor. I'm the one that's going to say, if I get 80 people to invest $3,000 into this event, then I'm basically right at that $250,000 mark. But I would rather focus on getting those 80 people getting success, that I would get success just as a result because of it. So I would rather, instead of having a personal monetary goal for myself, I'd rather have a tangible goal that I can work with. Now, I will say that the idea came from, I don't know if you know a gentleman by the name of Robert Allen.
No, I don't.
He's he was a real estate mogul, and he was the one that Multiple Streams of Income, I think, was his book. And one of the things he wanted to help 100 or 10,000 people to become millionaires. So right now I'm not at that level. However, I'd rather go after something that is more realistic, and helping 1,000 become to make $100,000 a year, to me is a very realistic goal. I'm not the one that's going to say, I'm going to make you a millionaire. I'm going to do all that. No, if you're running a business and you're making $20,000, $25,000, let's get you on that path to get into that $100,000.
Right.
So I'd rather have something that's realistic for people to achieve.
Yeah, because absolutely.
I mean, was it 33% of all businesses fail in the first 2 years? Is that the statistic? Yeah, 33% of all businesses fail in the first 2 years. 20% fail in the first year. So I'd rather focus on those people that might be barely getting by. Let's create an additional income stream for you.
I've exhausted my questions right now, and I just want to ask you: is there anything else you'd like to discuss that we haven't talked about?
I mean, the thing is, if you've got a dream and you really want to go after it, and I'm talking business-wise, start going after that dream, even if it's just doing tiny parts of achieving it. And then set yourself a goal, you know, a realistic goal. And then if you hit that goal, then you've got proof of concept. If you got proof of concept, then you can work on that to improve upon it. And this is what I do when I work with my clients is, you know, let's go and start doing some goals. Let's start getting you some success so that you can start feeling like, okay, I am accomplishing something. So go and even if you've got a job right now, I'm all about being in the gray. There's no black and white, or you have to do one or the other. What I tell people, because you know, I work with a lot of startups, is if you've got yourself a day job and you go out there and you start a new business, this does not mean you have to quit your day job. Do them both together. Your side hustle will be what you're bringing in some income. And then what I tell them, if your side hustle or your self-employed business hits this, and you hit the same level of income that you have at your job, then you can make a decision as to what you want to do next. Do you stay at your job? Do you quit your job? Do you go part time? Because the last thing I would ever tell anybody, and Lee, you know this, if you were 20 years in the military and you're 19 year, or you're going to retire 20 years and you're 19 and a half years in, and all of a sudden you start making, you won the lottery, or you started a business, would you just quit the army, you know, with 6 months to go or 3 months to go?
No, sir.
No, so it's not a black and white thing. And the thing is, don't look at this as black and white. Look at it as gray. And your gray is going to be different than my gray.
Go Army. No. Go Navy. I got to throw that in there, right? Especially since I see you're a fan of football. You're talking about the different time zones. But
Kevin, yeah, I missed the Pacific time zone.
Oh, man, and I love it. I love being able to get up at 10 o'clock in the morning and start watching NFL football. And then when they're playing overseas, good Lord, that's like 6 in the morning, right? So I love that. You can watch football and then have the rest of your day. That's amazing.
And that's something I do miss. And that's what they, that's what, even within anything. Like if I don't want to watch the 9 o'clock news here, it's at 9 o'clock. Out there, it's at 6 o'clock, and then I can go have dinner.
Yeah.
The 9 o'clock news out in the Pacific is a repeat of the 6 o'clock news.
It takes some changes, though. I mean, it takes some adjusting, too. So I know when I moved from the East Coast to the West Coast, it was, you know, some whatevers. But what was the defining thing that made me absolutely love it is exactly what you were speaking to. Football Sunday, right? And just being able to get up early in the morning is like, this trumps everything.
I'm a Green Bay Packers fan, and at the time of this recording, I wanted to watch a preseason game, but I don't think the game started until 9 o'clock at night. Like, dude.
I was about to say, so you're naming names now. I'm a Pittsburgh Steeler fan, so okay. Let me put that out there as well. Oh, ain't no sorry. We're about to put it to y'all this year. No.
Hey, we've got a new quarterback, so we'll see how it goes.
Yeah. Hey, but Kevin, thank you for joining me on Hindsight the Podcast and for sharing your journey, right? It's pretty amazing. Thanks for the tips on the writing experience, right? And then also some of those things to look out for in our entrepreneurial experience. Your insights will undoubtedly resonate with our listeners and, you know, as they navigate their own paths, right? Because everything is a little different. It's not black and white, right? But you can take those tips that you've provided and put them and apply them as needed. And I really appreciate that. And best of luck to you. Do you got a new book coming out?
No, not at the moment. I'm creating a lot of online courses. My at the time of this recording, my last course that I released was called Become a Self-Published Author, by the way. It is available on our website.
One thing I forgot. Where can the listeners find you if they want to know more about what you're doing or if they want to connect with you? Where do they go?
Well, the best place for them to go is our website, because I do have a lot of our links on there. And that website is Optimal Performance Academy. You probably heard that at the very beginning. OptimalPerformanceAcademy.org. Not .com, but .org. And on there, you will see that you can schedule a 30-minute discovery call where we can actually talk about you and your business. That is complimentary. And if we decide we want to work together, then we'll work together in some capacity. I do have all my online courses on there as well. And I also have links to my upcoming workshops, my upcoming webinars, as well as my virtual trainings as well. All of that is on our website.
There you go. OptimalPerformanceAcademy.org. O-R-G. Thanks again, Kevin, and best of luck with all your future, actually your current and your future endeavors. And we'll be in touch, okay?
Thank you very much, Lee. Have a good day.
You too. Thanks for tuning in to Hindsight the Podcast. I hope you enjoyed this episode. I know I did. And don't forget to hit that subscribe button to stay updated on future episodes packed with inspiring stories. Before you go, leave me a message with your thoughts, feedback, or suggestions for future topics. And if you're loving what you hear, please take a moment to rate this episode. Your feedback helps me to grow and reach more listeners just like you. So remember, life's a journey. Stay tuned, stay curious, and keep gaining wisdom through the power of hindsight. Until next time. Oh, and don't forget, subscribe, leave a message, and rate this episode.
When you look back in hindsight, everything is 2020. In hindsight.